commemorated in 1859 an epoch-making book was published. It was called The Origin of Species by Natural Selection by Charles Darwin. It had, apparently, nothing to do with our subject today. But in fact, the central influence. Why? You look at the dominant ideology of the first half of the 19th century up to, let us say, 1860. When I say the dominant ideology, I mean the dominant ideology in Western and Central Europe. Not because I'm Eurocentric or think there's nothing ever happened in India or China or anything else, but because as a matter of fact, this was the area, precisely because it was the initial area for the development of capitalism, that the most advanced thought took place. What was its ideology? Ideology can be summed up like this. It was expressed commonly in religious terms, but those who were not formally religious nevertheless accepted in one sense or another the basic idea. We can sum it up like this. The history of the world is contained in the first five books of the Jewish Bible, appropriated by the Christians. And what does it tell us? It tells us, to quote from Ecclesiastes, that essentially what is what has been. What will be is what has been. The most profoundly conservative notion. Now, of course, the world was changing extraordinarily rapidly at the time. But there is a lag between changes in the base and changes in the superstructure of ideas. I said Darwin's book was epoch-making. Was that because Darwin produced ideas which nobody had produced before? Absolute nonsense. You look at the great thinkers of the Enlightenment in the latter decades of the previous century. I choose one of the Scots, since the Scottish Enlightenment is commonly underestimated. Lord Monboddo wrote a book which was published in 1781, which in many ways anticipates Darwin's argument. It sank like a stone. The question is not the ideas as such, but what ideas become popular and why and what is their basis. Darwin's essential achievement was to demonstrate empirically, I emphasize, empirically, and this has nothing to do with what's called empiricism, that evolution of plant and animal species had in fact occurred under the account of Adam and the animals coming in two by two into Noah's ark was bullshit. To demonstrate it in such a way that it took a decade or so, nobody who had any pretensions to intellectual ability or integrity could maintain the old account. Now, it's absolutely true that Darwin's ideas were then taken up by bourgeois ideologists and used for reactionary purposes. We had an account, we had a talk, Darwin and Social Darwinism. I didn't attend it, I wish I had, I couldn't. But actually, I suspect that his emphasis was all the other way. I merely wish to say here that actually, around 1860, this notion, whatever detailed defects there may be in Darwin's work, was profoundly revolutionary and profoundly progressive. It is no accident that Marx wished to dedicate the first volume of Capital to Charles Darwin. He was not a revolutionary, not even a socialist. Why? Why? If we come to the application, the overspill, if you like, of those ideas to society, in other words, we come to progressive bourgeois anthropology. Progressive because it started from the notion that Ecclesiastes is wrong, that the biblical account is not valid, that actually there have been profoundly different societies in the past, and in particular, there have been profoundly different relationships between the sexes. Three figures are mentioned in terms of progressive bourgeois ideology. In 1861, two books were published. One, Das Mutterrecht, by a man called Backofen, a Swiss classical scholar, Hegelian and feminist, in which, under the influence of Darwin, he sought to show, exclusively actually, by reference to a critical study of the classical, by which he meant Greek and Roman literature, that actually, in the morning of time, descent had been reckoned in the female line and not in the male. And he demonstrated that beyond all cavil. Very interesting. Later bourgeois anthropologists will discuss very briefly later, never actually got to grips with this. They avoided the question. Demonstrated beyond all cavil that in the eastern and central Mediterranean areas, which we now know were the original background of civilization, descent in the female line only. He drew conclusions from this, relying on the dominance of mother goddesses, the earth mother and so on. They were also what he called matriarchal. They were ruled by women. I will argue later this is a mistaken conception. Nevertheless, it is fundamentally important. Why? Come on, you look at mid-19th century European society, what is called the Victorian family in parochial English. It's German, etc. equivalent. Read Ibsen, but it's Norwegian equivalent. That this is normal, natural, and inevitable. Backofen demonstrated it has not always been so. Here's a quote by two other people, one in the same year, one a year or two later. A man called May, a lawyer, employed first by the East India Company and then by the British government of India after the mutiny, who looked critically at the Indian society he knew.
It is very different.
Very different from what we have seen at the European world. His famous slogan was, from status to contract. Status meaning that actually a society in which, where you were born, not where you were born geographically, the group into which you were born is the important thing, not what you are as an individual. And he showed this was strong in India but disintegrating, and he regarded this as progress. Never mind the nature of his youth. He was a 19th century liberal. He was one of the first to point to a fundamental fact. These societies, the ones he observed, were dominated by the notion of kinship. He was followed by a man called McLennan, who I'll deal with very briefly, also a lawyer, sharp, smart, Scots lawyer, who made a good deal of money off the bar. There were no professional anthropologists in those days, thank God. Otherwise, they had no academic standing, who produced a detailed study emphasizing, again, the notion that early society was based on kinship. I don't want to talk about his ideas in detail, want to see him criticized, read angles and so on. But the notion of friendship. And finally, the culmination of this plan, a man called Lewis Henry Morgan, an American, North American, a Yankee in the old sense, who came from the North Sea, also a lawyer and a politician, active member of the Republican Party, and so on and so forth, produced in 1870 a book called, and this I have to check the title of, it's rather complicated, Systems of Consanguinity and Affinity with Human Family. And he followed it in 1877 with a book called Ancient Society. Now, let me give the essence of his notions and then his method. How did he arrive at them? The essence of his notion was this, that the past has been profoundly different from the present. Darwin. Actually, human society has gone through a series of stages in which all those notions that we take for granted, for example, about women, about legitimacy, about property, etc., did not exist. These evolved and and secondly, attempted to correlate these changes with changes in what I will call the technique of production. In particular, he had three stages of the development of human society. He divided into three. I will ignore these subdivisions. He was wrong about many of them anyway, but it doesn't matter. Three great stages, which is called savagery, the terminology of the time, meaning what we would call hunter-gatherer societies. Barbarism, by which he meant cultivators, agriculturalists, illiterate, without a class structure in the modern sense, and civilization, the development of class structure and so on. And he also, because he started from the materialist standpoint, there are two fundamental things about any society. One, how does one earn one's bread? How does the society actually subsist in a physical sense? How are the how is the material wherewithal for subsistence? All material, what have you produced? And two, reproduction. Again, not this directly from Darwin, the reproduction in Darwin's case of the species, in Morgan's case of the society. Now then, I don't want to spend time on the details of Morgan's scheme, but I must say this, in connection specifically with the practicing of living. He started with a hypothesis. In terms of presentation, he started with a hypothesis. Originally, we had the human groupings, because of course he took it for granted, man is a social animal, and he's quite right about that. This horde of people, horde, not meaning a large number, but in the original sense, simply a grouping, in which sexual relations are entirely casual, entirely promiscuous, they are not socially organized. Hypothetical stage. Then he thought he could trace the evolution from that situation to a number of other stages. I'll come to his method in a moment. Second stage. Actually, for a variety of reasons, he gets to the situation in which sexual relations are dominated by the notion of identity and incest. Identity, Meaning, I belong to a given group. He took it for granted that this meant matrilineal descent. For obvious reasons. You know, the facts of birth are unmistakable. The fact of paternity is much more obvious. Much more obvious. See, now, but of course, in primitive societies, it is the case on the basis of observation that everybody at an appropriate age is engaged in some form of sexual activity, right? The notion of paternity is not necessarily so obvious. Matrilineal descent. Then, and to see why he went further, we have to understand another. Unlike the people like Baffle, Men, or McCann, who observed from the outside societies that were clearly at an earlier stage of development, they thought, I believe correctly, than the societies they came from. Actually, Morgan, like his American predecessor Schoolcraft, actually, became, in a sense, part of a society at an earlier stage of development. Namely, the Iroquois in the Finger Lakes region of northern New York. Many still lived on the reservation. Back then, until they still do. Although I have been driven to the region, I never saw an Iroquois, but I'll take somebody's word for it, that they still exist. The point is, in Morgan's time, they still existed, the tribal structure still existed, and so on. And successful lawyer as he was in Rochester, he pursued as a communist. And I say he became an Iroquois. I'll explain what that means. So he learned the language, he studied their society. And understand his own ideological predisposition and background. He was a Republican. That didn't mean what it means in modern sentence today. Right? The more progressive, as a matter of fact, aspect of society. But he was able, he had the degree of objectivity to be able to look at these people. And as he says, in ancient society, once he had really got to know them, he had to go through ritual initiation and so on, he was astonished about three things. One, here's a society in which no standing army, no police, no written law, although it's of course tradition, no apparent means of coercion except that of the community in general. Now then, European race, this is impossible. This is impossible. Our attempt is self-control. But the rest, this is the first thing we observe. The second thing we observe astonished him much more. Because, of course, Morgan himself was a product of his society, therefore he had a version of the Christian ideology, he was a Presbyterian. I had read the book of Genesis more rapidly than I had an even thought. This is a society in which the status of women is extraordinarily high by North American standards. See what that means in a moment. In which, in reality, you could say that qualification about when he saw them in the stage of their disintegration, in which apparently women not women as an individual, but groups of women, and particularly older women, dominate. They are the inheritors of the tradition and so on and so forth. But third and most important, how is this possible? Because there is no private property except what we would today call personal property. I make something, it belongs to me. But the essential property, because the Iroquois were agriculturalists and marginal hunters, was in the land. This was not in the hands of individuals, any individuals. It was in the hands of kinship groups. These kinship groups were reckoned in the female line. Let's explain briefly, I'm paraphrasing Morgan's description. How's this work? Men and women alike work. The status of man, in many ways, is quite high. But in terms of the property relationship system, it is very low. Why? Because people come to the age of puberty. Incidentally, they go through various unpleasant and painful rites at that age, and so on and so forth. Never mind. Once they've emerged from this, they, it's true, well, we shouldn't have idealized this society, for Christ's sake. For notes' sake. what happens? They want any sexual partner. Anyone, everyone, is born, not only as a member of the tribe, the Israelite Confederation of Tribes, as a member of what I would call a clan. That is not the term that Morgan used. It's a Greek and Latin term, again, probably before. Clan. It's not ideal, but it's familiar to us. That is what you are born into. That is what you are dying. The clan. Membership of the clan is determined by your mother, and only by your mother, in terms of membership rights and so on. If I am born into the wolf clan of the Sanaka tribe, I remain in it until I die. I'm a man, right? But I can't manage. Which brings us to the second thing, the notion of incest. Now, incest today, used in a much more restricted sense in our society, with all sorts of nasty connotations and so on. It is essential to understand that the notion of incest for them, not only for them, but I would argue for previous generations up to perhaps a million years past, has nothing to do with biology. It has to do with who is a permissible partner or not. And that in turn has to do with the attempt to control the relationship between clan groups. Good, here is the Iroquois young man. I can't even put myself in this situation. He has to go, he's in the wolf clan, he has to go and chat up some young lady in one of six other clans. They don't have to be the same tribe, incidentally. Or vice versa. She decides we're having, we'll try to meet. Let us suppose that that relationship becomes stable. Casual sexual relationships in adolescence, by the way, do not count for them. They said of the offspring of such relationships, they are the child of chance, but they belong to their mother's clan. What happens? He goes to live, assuming the lady accepts him, into her clan. He has no rights in that clan, except insofar as he is tolerated as the partner of a member. Similarly, her brothers have to marry out. That is to say, they have to go to other clans in which they have no rights. Now, what does rights mean? Rights in the centrally important sense here means property rights. The property rights, the right to the land, the right to cultivate this plot, etc., etc., are exclusively in the hands of the clan collectively. And in practice, in terms of the old women of the clan, dominant within it. Therefore, you have a situation in which half, perhaps, of the people living in a given clan area, because they were geographically delimited, are not members of the clan. They are men. And by definition, belong to another clan. What happens if a house was quite common, even in Morgan's time. The lady becomes displeased with her partner. Actually, they go through a ritual and he is thrown out. I quote a much later example. I quote a much later example, late 20th century example. Purple Indians in the southeast, Arizona and so on, Ruth Benedict, as late as the 20s, described their ritual. Here it requires rituals more complicated and more cruel, but the purple ritual was very simple. When she got fed up with her partner, she, Benedict said, dumped his washing, which she normally did, at the doorstep. Cast out of society. No, it's very, very important to understand this. No, he has rights. Everyone has rights in a class society, in a clan society. He goes, literally, home to mother. I.e., he goes back to his own clan, of which he is a full member, and so on and so forth. And then he tries to chat up somewhere else in the family. Now, the important thing, you see, about this society is one, individual rights severely restricted. Not simply in terms of sexual partners and so on, but in a whole number of other ways. A member of a clan has obligations. Obligations which are enforced, and enforced very rigorously. I said we shouldn't idealize this kind of society. Really, they had only two forms of punishment. One, as we know from 20th century examples, was ridicule. You ridicule them, you know, so that they, or their fellows did, so that they hope to go forward and do better, etc. There is death. No, I am continuing. The violation of the incest taboo, incest being, not incest in house then, but say you have sexual relations out of the permitted group, or failure of other obligations, failure of rights, etc., etc., meant. No question about it. These societies in some ways were extremely brutal. But you see, the important thing about them, I am describing matrilineal clans, quoted by Morgan and many, many others, because Morgan also worked on the questionnaires. But not only did he live on and off for nearly 20 years with the Iroquois, he circulated questionnaires around the world, especially to missionaries and so on, and so he collected an immense amount of data demonstrating not only the universality of clan society, certain stages of development, but also its details. Now, from this, he drew certain conclusions, and it is these conclusions that were important to us. Before we come to them, however, we must look at the other side of the equation, development of the ideas of Marx and Engels. Because Marx and Engels did not act looking at primitive society. See? Early stage of development in the German ideology and also in the Communist Manifesto, you will see a sketch of the development of class society in what is essentially Western and Central Europe, as Marx himself said at a later stage in arguing with some Russians. What I have done is to outline a particular course of historical development, i.e. not an inevitable new one. But Marx and Engels were enormously inspired by Why? Let's go back to the dominant ideology. The notion that there is no fundamental change. Good! They have demonstrated that the transition from feudalism to capitalism was fundamental, that social relations depended on the Russian and so on and so forth. But then the influence of Darwin and the bourgeois, they came to realize, as they had not, as nobody had in 1844, which the German ideology was written, actually human society has a much longer history. And here it seemed to them was a demonstration that material circumstances had molded society from the beginning. Because Morgan's account was an imperialist one. History stages, savagery, barbarism, civilization, depending on technological criteria. The details of this criteria got matter to it. Agriculture, pottery, etc., etc., herding, and so on and so forth. They won't do the details. As a matter of fact, they won't do. The point is they were rooted in a study of material circumstances. And this is what. Marx, of course, in the 18th century, Marx himself spent an enormous amount of time collecting excerpts from the works he wrote, two things which were not published actually until the 1970s, under the title of Ethnological Notebooks, about what anthropologists, missionaries, magistrates, and so on had discovered around the world. They are quite fast. I don't actually own them. And I haven't actually read through them, but I only saw them in a North American library. But I assure you, they are very fat, published at enormous expense by somebody in the 70s. Why did Marx think this important? Because in terms of the ideological struggle, the whole notion that family structures are in some sense independent of the way in which the material means of production, the material wherewithal to survive, right? These two things are independent, will not stand critical examination if you take a long view. One. Two. That these things have changed and that those changes can be correlated, however roughly, with changes in the technique of production. This is what was central for Marx. Good, so I will now come to two things, one of which I'll deal with very briefly. Morgan was quite respected in his time. And for some time afterwards. As a matter of fact, the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I happen to have access to a set of, the last serious one, last serious work of scholarship, you look at the article on anthropology, it treats Morgan with great respect. It must have been written by an old fashioned scholar. Because by that time, of course, there was a reaction in terms of ideas, and I must talk about this reaction in terms of ideas, the rise of 20th century bourgeois academic anthropology, which has influenced many people, including a large number of people who think they are Marxists in one sense or another. It is important to understand the ideological roots of this. You see, around the turn of the century, not only anthropology, but in the economics that occurred much earlier, because that's the obvious and direct thing. Come on, we have to get rid of theories of value which in some sense depend on labour inputs. Clearly we have to, from a bourgeois point of view. Hence the development of neoclassical economics, an ideology. Not simply an ideology, by the way, it has an internal coherence and so on, an ideology. But more generally, around the turn of the century, the reaction in history, in linguistics, in anthropology, to what? And a whole number of other things. Two notions which in one way or another are ahistorical. That is to say, what exists now has no connection, no necessary connection with the past, and therefore the argument, it has evolved, it will change, it has internal contradictions and so on, are we there? Briefly, I'll stick to the anthropological field, indeed I have to, many other things to say. We have the rise of structuralism, French anthropology, what was called functionalism, the only one I'm going to talk about in terms of British, what was called configurationism in terms of the American. Now, all these are very different. In many ways, the approaches are very different, but they all come down to this. You look at what exists, it is unique, it has to be considered in its own terms. What is past is flat, irrelevant, and therefore no predictions about the future are possible. It was in this period, of course, that anthropology became respectable academic, and people started getting appointed to university chairs and so on and so forth. It is no accident. It is no accident. You see, and of course, this trend was enormously reinforced by events, 1914, the war itself, the Russian Revolution, the outcome, and so on. And we must not be too crude. Of course it is true. That is the life. They ask if any great foe who came to dominate in the 20s, English academic anthropology, has some pertinent criticisms to make of his predecessors. In particular, the fact they looked at given features of a particular society, they commonly didn't know the language, that's a fact, whereas he, in spite of himself, the British interned him, you see, in the Topian Islands as an enemy alien, had perforce learned the language of the people he studied and so on, that they did not look at the society as a whole, but you have to understand how that society relates in the present and so on. Many of his criticisms were valid. The same thing is true of the configurationist school in the States, Boas and his many disciples. I suppose the same thing is true of Lady Slap and Thorin France, all of the other families. But I will accept that. But you see, you have to ask yourself, why this reaction? What specifically did it have to say about the question of women in society? It had to say two things. Reactionary wing, actually, women have always been inferior, as a matter of fact, socially inferior, in every society, a proposition somewhat difficult to maintain in terms of facts, but more sophisticated, Mahasky, Lady Strauss, and so on, whether or not this is inevitable, right, since the previous not argued it was inevitable, it has happened, that you have to accept as a fact, and therefore it is unlikely to change in the future. Now, here we come to the whole question of the status of the Marxist summary, which is based on the progressive bourgeois anthropologists of the 19th century, based fundamentally on Morgan. Engels, little book, right, probably is very passive on the point. Based from 1940, it was horrible. Really does two things. One, it accepts Morgan's detailed scheme of social evolution and the technological reasons for change. And secondly, it restates the general historical materialist position, in particular arguing the state did not exist for most of the time in the past, it will not exist in the communist future, it is not inevitable, ditto the family, ditto the status of women, and so on and so forth. Now, these views became, in respectable bourgeois circles, the particular question, family, totally unacceptable. In a way they were not before 1914. You know, I refer to the 11th edition of the Britannica. Because, fundamentally, the ideas which refuted them, the structuralists, the functionalists, the configurationists, were socially acceptable, i.e. acceptable to the bourgeoisie. Therefore they built the chairs, therefore they taught the students, therefore we have something called bourgeois anthropology with a number of variants, not only British, American, and French, all of which were fundamentally ideological. Now, it's important to argue this, because I shall in a moment, and I'm sorry, I apologise to the chair, criticise myself the scheme which Engels accepted. It is important to understand that the criticisms made by the respectable bourgeois authorities have no pretense to science. Do not indeed attempt to grapple with the evidence. All right, we've gone very quickly then to, question of what is the present status? What is our present status? Bourgeois critics, I say, ideologically motivated. That does not mean that they can't make substantial and serious criticisms. And indeed, some criticisms were made early on. Moreover, there's something else. There's something called archaeology. Also a product of bourgeois civilization. But because of the nature of the subject, compelled to a large extent depend on material artifacts and so on, with a systematic materialist bias, even if they're idealists in their heads. I have to say also, the spillover into archaeology of physical science. Real science. Right? I am not going to be arguing about science and ideology. I would be delighted if someone raises it in the discussion. Three things. First, it is quite clear that the notions held by everybody in the late 19th and indeed early part of the 20th century about the duration of human society were entirely erroneous. Entirely erroneous. They thought in terms of thousands, 10,000 years. We now know. Actually, human beings, in the sense, not of people of our own species, but cultural tool makers, which is the Marxian definition, because cultural tool making implies language and therefore implies the ability to a certain extent for abstract thought and so on and so forth, go back at least 1.3 million years, not a few 10,000. Why does that matter? It matters in terms of the details of the Morgan Engel scheme because it depended to a considerable degree on terminology. You know the business? In a society, where in fact sexual relationships depend on pairs, relatively unstable pairs, but on pairs. Nevertheless, everyone in a given age group refers to everyone else in the age group as brother or sister, and refers to everyone in the previous age group as mother, father. Which, of course, I think this is the terminology used, not just amongst the Iroquois. Morgan collected a vast amount of material, particularly Britain, Australia, and so on and so forth, showing this was generally the case in kinship societies. His conclusion was that this is a relic, a linguistic relic of the period when you didn't actually know, right? The period of sexual promiscuity or group marriage and so on and so forth. Now, with all that, I thought a rather shady argument, but an argument about linguistic conservatism over a few thousand years. An argument about linguistic conservatism over a million and a half. If we are materialists, if we believe that society is shaped by the conditions of life in the here and now not very plausible. Secondly, and in many ways, this criticism came early by one of Logan's own collaborators, Michael Eastwood, who was a missionary, Logan Terrace in Australia. He, together with a man called Hewitt, who was a magistrate, an Australian service, investigated. In the case of Hewitt, they were dumped on, and he was dumped on top of them. He had no choice. The piece was working on them. Two societies of genuine hunter-gatherers. They still survive. Although, actually, they diminished very rapidly. As Hewitt says in his memoirs, when he first knew on every one of them, there were 1,500. Shooting, syphilis, tuberculosis, reduce them, i.e. the impact of the incomers, reduce them and so on in the time of his life. They don't exist anymore. Cameron Roy still do exist, more of them, to start with. Point is, these two societies were essentially similar in their way of life. They were hunter-gatherers on the desert, the semi-desert conditions.